This is an insightview.eu podcast. In this podcast, InsightView has again interviewed Anders Ellemann Christensen, general manager at Albatross Travel China, to get his take of the current situation in China after COVID-19. Anders, who lives in Beijing, also is a member of the supervisory board of the EU SME Center. Anders has worked and studied in China for the past 17 years. The podcast is a follow-up to a similar interview with Anders on April 29th.
Anders, the last time we made a similar podcast interview was on April 29. At that time, you were relatively downbeat about the reopening process in China. Therefore, we should maybe start with the usual question. Where is China and the reopening process? Are we entirely back to the situation before the coronavirus crisis erupted? Which sectors are doing fine and which industries are doing poorly?
Hello, Carsten, and thank you for having me again. Well, compared to April, things are not that different in the sense that it is still the same industries that are under pressure, which means the consumer industries, the service sector, is still in a recovery phase, whereas the industrial production and the fixed asset parts of the economy are either more or less on par with what was happening last year or even outgrowing last year. So again, we can see the industry sectors, especially the advanced product, the add value part of the industry has been moving up. And then we can see that fixed assets, railways, roads, dikes and stuff like this has been picking up and is really carrying the day at the moment, whereas the service sector is still weak and not quite where we had hoped it would be.
And where would you say the service sector is today compared to before coronavirus?
I think in a overview and the numbers we have seen, I think we're looking at an index maybe 70-75. Compared to last year at this time.
Maybe, Anders, you can just give an impression about the inflation situation in China.
Inflation here is very interesting because we know that huge stimulus has been given to the economy, and we know that money has been flowing into the general economy for quite a while. Now, it's been difficult to figure out where it goes to, but we think I can see that housing has, of course, always been inflated. It basically keeps the level. And then you can see that food pricing here has gone up. And that, of course, is driven by pork. But we can also see that general food pricing is going up. And that kind of shows one of the things that we've talked about before and that we've noticed is that inflation here kind of reminds me of this computer game called Whack-a-Mole, where the mole pops up and you hammer it. And right now we see, of course, the housing got hammered by all the enormous restrictions there is on buying houses in larger cities in China. But we also see it in the food pricing, where the government has to go in and do buy subsidized food from farmers, import enormous amounts of food from abroad, but still it keeps sneaking in. So I think broad-based inflation, you don't see that as much anymore because the consumer production products, these shoes, t-shirts, all of these things are still extremely cheap and electrical products. But you see it in housing and in food. And I think that's going to be a reoccurring issue.
When I get pictures and videos from Shanghai and other Chinese cities, they don't wear face masks any longer and there's no social distancing. Is it back to normal?
Well, I would say where I am in northern China, here in Beijing, we still have masks on whenever we go out. It is correct that I think there are some places where things are becoming more and more relaxed. There is still a large degree of tracking. I'm going to travel to our shipyard and see the ships that we are building in Nantong tomorrow, and I actually spent quite a long time registering with the health app that we have here in China. So things are not back to normal in the sense that the registration part has clearly been upgraded and is still very very much part of the daily life. Wearing masks, it's true, it is slowly fading in some parts of China, but still here in the north, we still use them.
It appears that Chinese policymakers have, first of all, pursued a policy of zero tolerance, focusing on eradicating COVID-19. On the other hand, Beijing has been more reluctant when it comes to launching the same aggressive stimulus measures to mitigate the economic impact, at least compared to Europe and the United States. Is it how you see the situation as well? If so, why the different approaches?
Well, I think stimulus in China was already, especially in fixed assets, as a fairly high level. And if we look at the debt to GDP, it has been rising quite a lot lately, the last 10 years. So I think we already had quite a level of stimulus going on. And I think adding to it would probably cause more problems than needed. That being said, it does seem like, especially railway, high-speed railway has been up. We saw a news out in the late spring about May that maybe somewhere between 1-2% of the GDP was invested in high-speed rails for the first quarter and maybe even into the second quarter, which means that there are significant investments going on. And also, I think maybe people have not quite identified yet what it is the government here is doing for stimuli. I think one of the stimuli that we haven't noticed, but I actually think is very significant, is that it was originally planned that there would be a revision of the retirement age in China. That was originally the plan for 2020, that they would raise the retirement age with 1 year from 60 to 61. That has not happened. So you could say that basically allowing people to retire 1 year earlier than what was originally planned this year is actually a significant stimulus too.
You have a leg in both camps, China and Denmark. Do you believe China has handled COVID-19 better than Europe?
Well, I think it's very difficult to do a value judgment on how to handle it, but what I think generally you can see from the sort of the systems that that encountered COVID-19, that political systems that have a large state involvement, which is actually Denmark, has a large public sector, and China has a large public sector. You see countries like this doing better economically. You see Denmark is one of those that did best, and you see countries that closed down fast and didn't try to keep the economy open and running while the virus was just entering the country. They seem to have come better out of it. So I would conclude that Northern Europe and China, due to the political models and the systems they have, may seem to have encountered better with the virus.
Today, the United States in particular and Europe have turned their back on China. On the other hand, it feels like COVID-19 is slowly turning China into a more closed economy, which is not necessarily seen as a bad thing, according to President Xi Jinping, because this promotes his goal of boosting self-reliance. Is this a fair conclusion? If so, is this a trend that will continue?
I think that a part of the political cluster system here, and again, this is very difficult to identify, but I still see the political system in China as being a cluster of very powerful sectors that work together. I think some part of the economy or the political system doesn't see the need for foreign engagement and involvement as much as we may have seen for 20 years ago. And I think in some ways that the idea of nationalism and national pride may sometimes have been a little too predominant here, and thinking that we may not need the rest of the world. Now, I would say economically that would be problematic, because what you have to remember is if an economy has a certain level, that actually means that you can't give away something. You need to add on to it in order to grow. So the export sector, for example, here in China, which is about 16 to 17%, it is correct that it has become a smaller part of the economy over the last 8 to 10 years, but it is, in my opinion, by far the most profitable part of the economy. So to give that up would be very problematic, and it doesn't seem like anyone in the system here wants to give that up. Now, the fixed asset investments that you are giving here in China, that is the railways, the roads, all of these fixed asset investments need to get you a return on investment. And that return on investment comes from consumers or people using these. So you need to keep a consumption activity internally. Now, if you have subdued, if you subdue or you keep the wages down for the consumers, well, then you may not get as much activity as you would like. And that's where I think foreign actors have a great part to be in, because I still think that foreign product, you see that in any economy, adds value to that economy where it enters. And it also puts pressure on the internal competitive system there to up their game. So I still think, and we have seen that in China for 40 years, that a market economy is still the best way to go. So I would say that there are forces here who may think that it is doable to close off the country and basically try to build a economy that doesn't necessarily need to interact. But I think that is built on the misconception that you somehow can replace what you already have. And that, I think, is going to be very difficult.
Generally speaking, it feels like China, a highly autocratic regime, has escaped the COVID-19 crisis less harmed than most democratic countries. Is this also how the Chinese sees the situation?
I think very much yes. I think most people here in China are very satisfied with how the crisis was handled. Again, there were issues in the beginning, but I think the way the story was spun, and then I think a very harsh rhetoric internally and externally kind of helped sway the public opinion that things were handled very well. And you can see that the way people are moving around is that they're doing very well. But again, I think the lesson that one should be learning from this is, again, Nordic countries did very well, and Germany did fairly well too. So again, I think systems with centralized free healthcare and a system where you have the strength to close down a country for a period of time seem to have fared very well. I'm kind of wary of making it into a democracy, not democracy thing, because I think the strength of a democracy might not lie in how it handles a crisis with a virus. I think one of the strengths about a democracy is how power is handed over. There's a formalized way of doing that.
Angela Merkel, who has advocated strong links with China in the past, is planned to step down in 2021. This could turn the European Union significantly more hostile towards China. Soon, however, China, with 1.3 billion people, might not need the rest of the world, at least if it's up to Xi Jinping. In this context, are many European companies too dependent on China today?
I think it's it's easier to answer that question by looking at the trade between China and Europe. So there is last year there was 1 trillion RMB, I think it was close to 140 billion euro in trade surplus to China and the capital account. I think was breaking even that last year. But it means that in terms of trade, it is always usually better to be a deficit country than a surplus country, because usually the buyer is king. That means that they can diversify out. So I think the European Union will try to leverage that. It seems that the work I've done in the EU lately, that the approach from the EU side is much less aggressive than what we see from the US side. But what we will see probably from the European side is that European countries seem to be able to work better together to reduce this trade surplus. I think Germany and Northern Europe will always be more positive towards China as from the political side. I don't, population-wise, I haven't seen much lately. But because we are Northern Europe, are export economies, and we are one of the few where we may have a chance to actually grow our exports to China, whereas Southern European, Eastern European markets and economies are less geared towards it. So I think we'll have a part of the European Union, the northern part, that will be more pro-China, and France and Southern Europe will maybe have less, will see less of an idea in working in China.
The last question. I know that you are not as optimistic about long-term growth in China. How come?
I basically believe that economies are based on four pillars. One is the geography, one is the demographics, one is the institutions that are built around, that this economy is built around, and then fourth is neighboring economies. And I think these four constitute 99% of an economy's development. Now, lately we've seen during the COVID that a lot of pundits and I've read in the media and I've heard perceptions that somehow there's this national magical element that makes an economy unique compared to other economies. We have it in Northern Europe, where many people basically think that Germans are more industrious and more disciplined. And we saw it in a very bad way internally in Europe, where people were saying that Southern Europeans were somehow lazy and that was their fault, their own fault, that they had too long retirement schemes, and that somehow Northern Europeans were more industrious and worked harder. And that is, of course, not correct. I think the internal changes in Europe were very much due to structure and demographics and how institutions handled this. We could say that Northern Europe basically subdued its wage payments and it kept down its consumption. It then exported outside of Europe and internally in Europe. And then it had 500 to 600 million people that could help it absorb whatever access, currency or access surplus that it adopted. So in that sense, these economies grew. They had full employment. Now, China has done the same. The problem in China is that you have a demographics now that has changed significantly. And by that, I mean that you are seeing an economy where within the next 10 years, you have maybe 250 to 300 million people who will retire. You have a very low retirement age. Right now, it's 55 for women, 60 for men. As I just mentioned earlier in the interview, it hasn't changed this year. And you also have somewhat uneven demographics compared to male and females being born due to cultural preferences here for male children. And that puts an enormous pressure on the future development of China, and that is one of the things where I am very worried, because what China needs from now on is actually to sort of let go of the state capitalist, very hardcore investment-based growth. And then you need to go into consumption-based, and not only that, but it will be a, it should be a broad-based consumption. That means that you have to get people in the countrysides, in the fifth, sixth tier cities, in the Chun and the Xian, to act these small farm units or even villages. They need to have their income raised, and they haven't actually had a very strong saving. They haven't saved for a pension. And if you see, even the cities have pension issues, because we had a large part of the pension saving system that didn't really work very well until five, six years ago. And the numbers I've seen is only 5% of China's GDP has been put aside for savings. Now, that means that you, in the future, will have to take value, because, again, I think the economy based on growing on consumption will grow much slower than what you've seen when you see fixed asset investments and export-driven investments, because the return on these investments in a growing economy with a young demographic will give you very high growth numbers. But you now have an aging demographics, you have a economical model where it is not fixed asset. The fixed assets have been more or less done. China has a very nice infrastructure. And even if we do an electronic infrastructure, it has a very nice one too. Most people are covered. It also has a very big export sector that will have issues growing in the future. So that means you'll have two sectors that will either diminish somewhat or will be the same. And you'll have a consumption that will then need to carry the growth numbers from before. And I don't think we'll see that unless you get a very broad-based economy. And that means taking wealth from SOEs, from government funding of fixed assets, and moving it into pension systems and consumers, low-income consumers. The future Chinese model, as I see it right now, looks a lot like the Japanese one we saw in the 80s and the 90s, where Japan had grown to a certain size, it had an aging population, and then it needed to switch around wealth. And that actually showed us some very different growth numbers in Japan. And we saw that it kept being pushed in with stimulus. Now, another interesting factor about the Chinese economy is that China is a non-immigrant country, which means there are absolutely almost no immigrants into China. There is no adding labor from outside. All is based internally. And that lately has been even been more exclusive, more excluding. So it's much more difficult to actually obtain a work permit or a green card in China than it was 10, 15 years ago. So you have an aging population. You have no immigration at all. What you need is a political system where participation is important, especially because you need to understand and you need the system to self-regulate so that money flows to those that need it. And that's some of the things that I'm going to be interested in seeing how they will solve it here. Because you need your population to somehow engage in, and have a voice in their own situation in order to find the correct remedies. And that is one of the challenges I will be very interested in seeing how they will solve it here. Because the political system and the economy is so much like the European and the American economy and the Southeast Asian economies around it. And that way, I don't think China is unique. It is still part and integrated in a modern economy system. That growth is slowing doesn't necessarily mean that there won't be any opportunities in China. There will be a lot of opportunities just because of the sheer size of the economy. The opportunities now will, though, be in consumer-based products or services. And in that sense, things have changed because before you could show up here, build a factory, export back home. You didn't need to necessarily speak the language or anything. Now, I think for a company to succeed in China, you will need to have a deep knowledge of the market. You will have to have people here who you can communicate with. You will need a larger flexibility. But it is still definitely possible to find niche markets. And niche markets in China are huge, where companies can grow. But they need to learn how to navigate the Chinese social media in order to do marketing. They need to know how to navigate rules and regulations in China. And they also need to do an internal process where they commit to China. So I would say that China has gone from being an easier place to do business to becoming a much more complicated place where you need a lot more market insight, you need a lot more expertise. But there are still a huge amount of possibilities here. Now, it does also mean that mistakes here are now much more expensive than they've ever been before. And it also means that you have to be doing a lot more homework to identify sectors where you can work and where you can sell your product. So I think the European Union and Denmark will have to train more and do more to educate young business people here in China. And that's why I'm engaging now in the work of the EU SME, because I basically think that the European Union has to double up and really start investing, and together again with China, in educating people how to navigate the Chinese market. Because the upsides and the wins here are still very extreme, and especially in consumer products. And you're also seeing that as the economy and the population are becoming more and more advanced, you'll see in the larger cities, there are consumers that are completely comparable to consumers in Europe or in the US. So that means that the market for products originally sold in Denmark here in China is going to grow, and it's going to grow a lot the next 30, 20 years. And to mention one industry would be the travel industry. We have 300 million people retiring over the next 10, 15 years. And these are some of the Chinese with the highest purchase power in the history of China. So in that way, for the travel industry, that will be extremely interesting.
Thank you, Anders, for taking part in this podcast.